I thought I'd go ahead. I do have a, there's more material here than I probably try to present in some sermons anyway. So I thought it'll probably be good for me to get an earlier start on it. I want to present to you a parable of my own. It'll kind of give you a feeling for where I'm going and why I'm going there. So let me just get into it and tell you. Supposing you walked into a historic building. Now, many of us do this on vacations or days off or things. We sometimes go see what the local history of the local culture in a particular town. If we happen to be going to and from the feast or going somewhere, sometimes we want to stop and see a historic building, the the Lincoln House or the somebody's home that was famous, or those kinds of things. And oftentimes they've made them into little museums with things about that individual in them. And sometimes stopping to see one of those places, you will walk in and you'll sometimes see old photographs. And the old photographs will contain that individual who's famous, and there will be a bunch of other people in the picture. And sometimes they're family members, sometimes you're not sure who they are, and sometimes the tour guide will tell you, well, the individuals you see in this picture were all family members of this famous person. Whether, let's say, Lincoln happens to be very famous in this area, and especially down through Springfield. I just rode through and passed a number of his, some of the museums and things that are down there on the Lincoln Trail. On my way up here, I do that every couple of Sabbaths anyway. And you see things about the individual. Sometimes in the picture, the people in the picture, you don't quite know who they are. Who are these individuals? I have such a picture myself. My great-grandfather on my mother's side is pictured at their ranch house. I guess you can call it a ranch house. I don't know. Back then it was probably a ranch house. I don't know what they really would have called it back then. But he's pictured along with a whole bunch of other family members, and I haven't a clue who they are. I think I can guess about a couple of them and maybe, guess that they're related to him, but, exactly what the relationships are, I can't tell. And unless somebody actually wrote down when the picture was taken in kind of a map-like affair or on the back of the photograph, the person on the extreme light is so-and-so and the person at the bottom is so-and-so and that kind of thing, you have a little map. Now, sometimes in history museums, they will have a little map that tells you who's in the picture and who they are. But you can often go in and a tour guide will say, well, this is the famous person, obviously, but the others, we don't know who they are. And we can't figure out who they are. And so sometimes there's a map drawn, and sometimes the map is missing, so basically the tour guides just throw up their hands and say, I don't know, we obviously recognize Lincoln in the picture, but who the other people are, we don't know. Now that sometimes happens in families. We probably all had it happen with a picture maybe of our ancestors somewhere along the line, and we don't know who they are. My mother's family's past, I know some of the individuals involved, but not all. And some of us have done more careful study to find out who our relatives are in various pictures, and some of us haven't. But consider that the New Testament, or in the New Testament, is the record of Jesus Christ, and his sacrifice is very much like one of those pictures. His sacrifice is very much like one of those pictures. We'd like to know a whole lot more about him and about that sacrifice, especially when we see that there are a whole bunch of people in the picture and we don't quite know who all they are. In this case, not people in the picture, but reasons for the sacrifice. Reasons for what he did, why he did it the way he did. Those are things we'd like to know a great deal more about. One author put it like this. The author said, "For though the sacrificial work of Christ has as many aspects as there are great typical sacrifices in the Pentateuch, the Passover and the sin offering hold a practically exclusive prominence in our theology," and I would add today. And that's very true. if you ask anyone who claims to be a Christian in the world, what did Christ die for? They would say he died for our sins. And if you asked, what else did he die for? They would probably go, I don't know. I have no idea. And if you asked a church member today, what did Christ die for? What response do you think you would get? A very similar response. Christ died for our sins. And if I asked, what else did he die for? A lot of people would throw up their hands and say, I really don't know. The average church member simply does not know much beyond, and I could say, the concept of Passover and the concept of atonement. Passover in that he is our personal sacrifice, and atonement in that he is the atonement for sin, or the ultimate sacrifice for all sin. But beyond that, and perhaps we would know a few more things like, well, he died so that we can be forgiven. He died so that we can receive healing. But when you start to get too much beyond that, most people can't tell you what's going on, can we? And I probably couldn't have gotten very much more specific than that myself a few years ago either. In terms of the purposes of his death and sacrifice. But certainly his resurrection is a demonstration of certain things, and his life is a demonstration of certain things, but sometimes we don't put all those things together and say, why did he come, have to live a perfect life and die? I mean, if you put all that into the mix, it's very hard to conceptualize all of it and to put it all together in a package that really makes a lot of sense. They likely have no idea why he died for sin. And most of us probably don't know a lot of things in that area. The people in the world certainly don't know a great deal about the reason for the sacrifices. I'd like you to turn over to John chapter 18 to begin this. John chapter 18 and verse 1. John chapter 18 and verse 1. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples over the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. Now, this is probably a historical event that he did quite frequently. Just about every time Jesus came to Jerusalem, he probably walked this path, and it was somewhat of a habit. Because it went from the Mount of Olives across the Kidron Valley and up into Jerusalem, and vice versa when you were going back the other way. Something that Jesus did probably every year during his earthly ministry as he visited Jerusalem for the holy days. He probably visited the Garden of Gethsemane frequently, and probably every time he was in Jerusalem. But certainly around Passover time, and he probably walked this route two or three times, at this specific time of the year at least, and he probably, at least during the spring holy days, I'm certain that he probably did, and some of the other days as well. But this brook of Kidron, or this valley that you had to cross between the Mount of Olives and the Mount of Jerusalem, was kind of interesting. It was a ravine. In which a very, very small stream passed. And that small stream was called the Brook of Kidron. And that brook was kind of, well, actually there was a drainage ditch that came from the Temple Mount where the sacrifices were being made. And that drainage ditch came down to the brook and basically dumped the blood of the many Passover lambs that were being killed on Passover day at the temple. It dumped that blood right into the small brook. Now Jesus, as he walked over this brook on his way up the hill to Jerusalem, at least on Passover day, would have seen a very red creek, a very red brook Kidron running and bubbling down the hill. The blood flowing into the Kidron would have made it almost red with the probably 200,000 lambs that were being killed in his day on the Temple Mount and those sacrifices in the afternoon and the evening. it probably would have been a tremendous reminder to him of what was coming and what his sacrifice would involve. When Jesus and the disciples crossed it on this day, in the previous 2 to 3 years before Christ himself was crucified, I'm sure that it was a tremendous reminder to all of them. Maybe the disciples didn't quite get the point and realize what they were looking at, but it's an awesome reminder of the cost of sin. And it would have reminded them all of that. It's interesting that the book of Revelation records that the blood will be up to the horses' bridles outside the city in this great day of the battle of the Lord. Perhaps this very brook Kidron will one day flow with men's blood as deep as the horses' bridles this time, rather than the pink color, perhaps, of the red bloody brook from the lambs that were being killed in Jesus' day. I want to talk about the sacrifices today. I want to talk about what they mean, how they relate to us today. Even though we look at the Old Testament, oftentimes people in the world tend to say, what's the point in studying the sacrifices? They all typify Christ, so, and Christ has come and died, so, you know, why look at the Old Testament? There's nothing there for us to learn. Well, there is. There's a great deal for us to learn about Christ, about why he died and what he died for. And if we only had the Old Testament, there would be a great deal we would not know about the function of the sacrifices that God gave to Moses in terms of giving to the Levitical and the Aaronic priesthood to sacrifice animals. But the New Testament reveals a great deal to us about the sacrificial system of the Old Testament that we could not have understood. And we still probably could not understand it today if we didn't have the Old Testament to tell us a great deal about what it is that Christ was doing and why. We would learn a great deal from the Old Testament by having the New Testament, but we also learn a great deal about the Old Testament from having the New Testament. Vice versa. They both explain many things that are occurring in each other and the components and what's going on. Today we live in a predominantly Protestant Catholic society, if you want to talk about the religious element that's present, at least in this country. All things Old Testament, all things Jewish, have for centuries been underemphasized or ignored by pretty much all of modern Christianity as a whole. The world looks at Christ's sacrifice as complete, as whole, it's done with, it's over with, and it has replaced the sacrificial system of the Old Testament, and therefore there is nothing to be learned or gained from it. But they're sadly mistaken. Many cultures outside of the U.S. still maintain their own sacrificial systems, their own sacrificial rituals, whether they have to do with Christianity or not, probably not. But in some religions, even in Spain, of course, we have bullfighting. There's all kinds of things that go on in the world that are almost of a religious nature in terms of the sacrifice of animals. There's cockfighting. There is slaughtering of animals in connection with religious groups by many groups around the world outside of Christianity. Up until 70 AD, the temple in Jerusalem stood on Mount Moriah, and it was the center of religious worship among the Jews who had returned from the great Babylonian captivity years before under Ezra and Nehemiah. In the temple, the sacrificial traditions and the rituals instituted by Moses and Aaron continued to be performed daily as the law commanded them to be done. Animals of all kinds were sacrificed, whether it be bulls or heifers or sheep or goats or doves, whatever it happened to be on that sacrificial altar at the time outside of the camp of Israel. Some were sacrificed on the altar, some outside of the camp of Israel, or what they'd call outside the city. This system, this temple and the altar, played a tremendous role in the early success of so many people coming into Christianity. Sometimes we forget that, but that is the case. The apostles were able to work with and influence many who had been devout Jews, who had followed the system of sacrifice all of their lives, And suddenly, when God began to call them and open their minds, all of the sacrifices became clear. It was like, this is what the Messiah was to do. That's why we did all this. This is, and when they began to see that and understand that, God began to open their mind, and you know, the significance of all the sacrifices began to make sense. And they understood Christ as Messiah and the sacrifice that he made. But not having a background in the sacrifices, there wasn't the depth of appreciation for what the Messiah was going to do. The impact of Jesus' death right at the very hour in which the sacrifice of thousands of lambs in the temple was usually underway for the all-important Passover season must have been a very moving and very terrible shock in some ways to many who had known Christ and seen his miracles. Things would have become even more significant and clear to many who were called, having observed this in the coming of Christ as the Lamb of God, who was to take away the sins of the world. John 1:29. We could go all the way back to the first sacrifices that are offered and mentioned in the book of Genesis, but I won't take time to go back there. If we do, I won't really have time to cover, even in two sermons, the primary sacrifices themselves that we find in Leviticus 1 through 7. If we jump to the first century time just after Christ was crucified, I think we can see why so many of the first century Jewish Christians might have thought that the Gentiles should be excluded from ever being involved in the sacrificial rituals which began during the days of unleavened bread. God inspired the New Testament church to understand that it was no longer necessary to participate in the temple rituals after Christ, the ultimate sacrifice, had died. The Apostle Paul explains that in great detail in the book of Hebrews. Particularly Hebrews 7 and 8 do so, but there are other chapters that explain part of that as well. And I say Paul wrote the book of Hebrews. There are a lot of scholars today think he didn't, simply because his style doesn't seem to match his other books. But when you realize the purpose of Hebrews, and you realize that Paul probably wrote it in Hebrew, although we don't know for sure, and then someone later, maybe Luke or someone else, translated it back into Greek, and we only possess the Greek copy today of it. We don't have the original, but we, you know, the copies we have are all in Greek. But when you change languages, you lose your style of the way you write, and that frequently disappears. And so scholars today think, well, it wasn't Paul because it's not his style. Well, there's probably a lot of reasons why it's not his style. Because he's writing about a subject he's not addressed before in the 7 or 9 books that he wrote previous to Hebrews. He had not written as he does in Hebrews either. Subject matter is completely different. So there's a lot of reasons why it's probably Paul's book. But in it, he explains a great deal about the temple sacrifices and why the Jews and the early Christians no longer needed to go to the temple for sacrifice, and the fact that Christ's ministry now replaces the ministerial process of Aaron, or the Aaronic priesthood as well. But it didn't fully come until Paul was inspired to write that Jesus Christ is our Passover. When he first wrote that in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 7, it began to dawn on the entire Christian world what had happened and how things were changing. Consequently, his sacrifice clearly replaced the need to slay a paschal lamb. No longer a need to do so. Later, Paul writes in Hebrews and presents basically a picture becomes much more clear to us in terms of the first century Jewish Christian and their understanding. A lot of things begin to come into focus because of the book of Hebrews. God has forbidden human sacrifices, but he commanded animals to be sacrificed by ancient Israel. A great lesson needed to be conveyed to ancient Israel, but also to us. And the lesson remains just as powerful for us today as it was for ancient Israel. The cost of sin, the shedding of innocent blood for it. However, we're going to see that not all of the sacrifices given to ancient Israel had anything to do with sin. And that's one of the things that oftentimes people have no idea, no clue that that's the case. But let's take a few minutes now and kind of go through some of the sacrifices and see something about their various types and purposes. And I forgot to get the handout out of my briefcase. I'm sorry. Let me go get it and I'll pass it out. They do have one, and they do have copies, I believe, in Bloomington, so they can go ahead and pass those out as well. You think about what you're about to do in your service, so I didn't have enough time to think about that. That handout will kind of give us a rough idea and just a few words about each of the five different types of sacrifices. They're numbered down the left-hand side so that you can see them. In general, there were five basic types of sacrifices and six blood sacrifices. A blood sacrifice was where an animal died or was killed and blood was shed. A meat offering, as the King James Version has it, or a meal offering, which is the fifth one on the list, is not a blood sacrifice. So you're probably wondering, how do you get six blood sacrifices out of five sacrifices, or five types of sacrifices? The first three on the list are blood sacrifices. And we can go through each one of those, and I'll show you how we get to the six blood sacrifices as we go down the list. The first one is the burnt offering on the left-hand side. And it was called Ola, or Hola in Hebrew. It was a burnt sacrifice. Number two is the sin offering. It was called Chatatat in Hebrew, and it's very difficult to pronounce. But that's kind of as close as I can get to it. It has a very guttural het letter in it as well. It's difficult to pronounce, but that's, you know, a lot of Hebrew words are difficult to pronounce. Number three is called the trespass offering, or asham in Hebrew. Number four is called the peace offering. And this is shalamim in Hebrew. It's very similar to shalom, which also means peace. Similar to shalom. There are three types of peace offering that we're going to get to a little bit later. The fifth and final major category of sacrifice here is the meal offering. And this is minichot in Hebrew, or a gift or tribute offering, as they would call it. So the five major types are the burnt, sin, trespass, peace, and meal offering. These are the five major categories. All five are types of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ that he made. Each type tells us something about what he did, and there are types within types. So it gets kind of complicated after a while in trying to explain all of the details of how it works. But you're probably wondering, how do we get six blood sacrifices out of the five? Well, the first three there that you see listed, the burnt, sin, and trespass, are the first three of the six blood sacrifices. Then the next one is the peace offering, but there are three types of peace offering. There is a, I'm trying to remember, there's a free will vote, or votive, and I can't remember what the third one is. I haven't got the thing in front of me here. That's all right. Might help if I got it in front of me as I'm trying to explain it too. Three types that are listed here. There is a thank, votive, and free will, A, B, and C, that come below peace offering. Thank, votive, and free will. And we'll explain each of these as we get to it later on in the sermon here too. But basically that's how we get those three, A, B, and C. So it's 1, 2, and 3, A, B, and C, are your six blood sacrifices where an animal dies. The fifth one, of course, the meal offering, no animal dies at all. It is strictly dealing with corn or flour or oil, salt. Those are the components primarily of the meal offering. You're now probably wondering some other things as to why the chart, what's significant about it. There's a lot of information on the chart, at least in brief. But there's a great deal more to the sacrifices themselves than you can actually put on any kind of a handout or chart. So there's different types, there's different categories of them as well. I'll try to cover some of the meanings and the types and the parallels that we have both with Christ's sacrifice and what's going on spiritually in the Christian's life. There's a lot of things that go with the sacrificial system. Leviticus chapters 1 through 7, if you want to turn over there, and we'll start looking at those chapters in particular here in a minute. But that's one of the places we can go. You can read about them there if you want to actually look into each of the sacrifices there listed in those seven chapters. They're actually listed in chapters 1 through 6, but then there's a summary in chapter 7 that covers some things that weren't covered in the previous chapters. So there are two major categories of sacrifices in an overall sense. First, there's the sweet savor, or what we would call a voluntary free will type of offering. That's something that was not demanded, not required. It was something that is simply offered by the believer. Secondly, there is the sin offering. Now, that one is required. You know, if you sin, then you're required to make a sin offering. And those are the two distinctive differences overall. All of these five categories, all of the sacrifices fit into one of those two categories. It's either free will and it's sweet savor to God, or it is a sin offering. So it's one of those two categories. All of the offerings fall into those two categories. Excuse me. There are one or two items that I need to clarify here, too, before we even get to Leviticus 1 through 6. And those are the other offerings or the other sacrifices that are mentioned in the Old Testament, but that are not actually part of these five that are part of the sacrificial system. The morning and evening sacrifice is separate and distinct, and we find it, I believe, in Exodus 29, verses 39 to 41. And basically, the morning and evening sacrifice was a lamb that was offered, one in the morning, one in the evening. And it was considered a whole burnt offering. It was offered in the evening and burning on the altar, basically by the tabernacle, all night. And the smoke of that animal burning continued all night up into the heavens. In many ways, it is a reminder or a continual reminder, not of sin and not for sin, but it was a continual reminder of God's people, a reminder to him, and it was an appeal for acceptance as his people. It was an appeal for acceptance. It was offered in the evening. It burned on the altar by the tabernacle all night. The smoke went up continuously all night for the acceptance of the people all night. In the morning, another lamb was slaughtered and put on the altar, and it burned all day for the acceptance of the people. Okay, that's basically the evening and the morning sacrifice. The next type of sacrifice we encounter is the atonement goats in Leviticus 16. Two goats, and they're mentioned there in Leviticus 16. I can give you an entire sermon on those, and I won't do that here. Obviously, don't have time. But that's another category of sacrifice. Then we have the paschal lamb that is offered in Exodus 12. That's a third type of sacrifice that we're all familiar with in Exodus 12. It's in Leviticus 22, and I think again in John 13 as well. If you think about Jesus Christ as the paschal lamb washing the feet of the disciples in John 13, it begins to come clear that he is acting in the role of the Passover lamb in John 13. The next one is called the red heifer. The red heifer. And that particular sacrifice is discussed in Numbers 19. And it was used for purification, or the purification rites of the people of various kinds. Again, it's a subject that consumes way too much time for one sermon. And we come now basically to the five types. We're coming back to them again. I'm going to talk about the burnt offering now, which is the first one on your list, or the first one in your chart, handout. Remember that Jesus gave himself of his own free will. He did not have to come to die for sin. He gave himself of his own free will. His sacrifice would have fallen into the sweet savor, as we call it, category, or the burnt offering category. The most important thing for us to, I think, remember and discover about that particular form of the sacrifice and to contemplate here is that the burnt offering has nothing at all to do with sin. Period. Nothing. Nothing at all. And some people wonder, well, what's the burnt offering all about then? Yet it is the very first of the offerings discussed and was given to Israel before the sin offerings were even given in Leviticus chapter 1. And it's perhaps the least understood concept in all of the offerings by Christians today. Now, why is that? Why is it just kind of overlooked? It's frequently not understood by most church members, and it is a sweet savor offering. Jesus Christ offered himself of his own will to be pleasing to God. Sweet savor offerings have nothing at all to do with sin. I want you to think of the word acceptance when you think about this sacrifice. Jesus Christ sought to be accepted by his Father as the one who would be sacrificed. To be accepted. Jesus Christ was God. He was perfect in his life, perfect in righteousness, perfect in his complete devotion and love and his life before God. He was the only one who could be accepted by God. And that's something we may have trouble understanding as a Christian today. To be accepted as adequate, to be accepted as complete, to be accepted as perfect in every way. And he was the only one holy enough to approach the Father in the first place. If you and I could lead a perfect life without sin, we would not be able to be accepted by God. You realize that? Sometimes we don't grasp the concept of God's holiness. We are part of a creation that is not perfect. We are part of things that are not perfect. And even if we, in all of our ability, somehow manage to not sin, we still do not qualify to be accepted by God. And oftentimes we ask the question or we think about it. I do this sometimes when I'm talking with young people who are usually in their late teens and they are second generation Christians and they're coming to me about counseling for baptism. And they want to know, well, you know, I've never murdered anybody. I haven't committed adultery. What do I have to repent of? What do I need to be repenting of in order to be baptized? One of the concepts that young people, and sometimes even Christians, don't have the full concept of is that it isn't entirely the sins that you do that are the problem. It is what you are. We are not perfect. And what we are, whether we sin or not, our nature, our life, everything we are as human beings, whether we've sinned or not, is not acceptable to God. Jesus Christ is the only one who could be accepted by God. And that's the concept behind the, or one of the concepts behind the burnt offering, the whole burnt offering. Acceptance by God. He was the only one who could hold communion with God. Now, that's a very Protestant word. A lot of people don't like the word communion because they use it in a particular manner. But communion just simply means fellowship with God. No one has the right to fellowship with God. And could be accepted in fellowship with God. Without intervention. Without the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. So he was first offered as a whole burnt offering to God. First, to gain acceptance. This burnt offering represents the work of Jesus Christ. It is his worship and his communion with God for us. That's what he's doing. We cannot approach God. We cannot gain acceptance by the Supreme Holy Father of all as human beings, even if we never committed a single sin. And many people don't grasp that. How do I say it? Do you remember what God told the children of Israel when he said, don't come near the mount, you'll be thrust through, if you come near the mount, or if any animals cross near the, build a fence around the mount, don't let the people get near the mount, or they'll be killed, they'll be thrust through, so to speak. God's holiness is so great, we cannot live in his presence. Sinful or not. As a human being. And sometimes we don't grasp how holy God is. Yet it is a major part of what Christ did for us. We have not seen or heard the Father. We have in no way had real contact with the Father, except through what Jesus Christ has done to open the veil into the Holy of Holies, which represented the throne of God. In addition to the burnt offering, which is symbolic of the work of the saints as the children of God and the priests of God and the kingdom of God yet coming, so it's very prophetic and yet to be a major part of the future of the kingdom of God. Even if sin offerings are no longer necessary in the millennium, whole burnt offerings will be. People need to learn the concept of the fact they cannot come to God except by intervention, sinner or not. We will not die for sin as Christ did once we're made spirit, but we will be able to offer our entire lives and being in service to God in perfect righteousness as Jesus did and is doing, represented by the whole burnt offering. It is our destiny to be the burnt offering in symbol. Not literally, obviously, symbolically, but that's part of your becoming priests to God in his kingdom. Offering whole burnt offerings. Because at that point, you as children of God will be perfect. You will be able to offer acceptance offerings to God for others, for human beings. But also remember there are three ways that we see Jesus Christ appear in the burnt offering itself and the other offerings as well. First of all, he appears, and I number them A, B, and C. He appears as the animal or the sacrifice itself, because he was the one who sacrificed himself. He also appears as the priest who is offering the sacrifice. And C, he is the offerer of the animal, the one who brought the animal to be sacrificed in his place. In some sacrifices, he appears as one. In some sacrifices, he appears as another. And there's symbolism in how some of these sacrifices are carried out, in which he's acting in one role. Sometimes he's acting in multiple roles, and sometimes he's acting in a combination of roles or a single one of those three roles. And you have to kind of look at the what Moses is saying in order to interpret which one it is that he's acting in. And he would, of course, the burnt offering is offered on the bronze altar or the brazen altar, as it's called, I think, in the King James, and I'm not sure the New King James uses brazen altar as well. But it's basically an altar made of bronze, so it was called the brazen altar as well at that time. No part was given to the priest or the offerer of the burnt offering. The priest and the person offering the animal did not receive any portion of the animal. Because who was this sacrifice aimed at? It was given to God the Father. Therefore, the offerer has no right to any of it. Neither does the priest who is offering have any right to any of it. So the animal was burnt totally on the altar. And so we see Christ's primary role listed, number one, as the sacrifice necessary for God to accept him as priest and offerer. He offers himself, and he is the offering, the sum total of the offerings. And this was an offering of the first order, as we call it, or what we might call a first-class offering, because the animals involved in the first-class offerings were expensive animals. Bulls, rams, animals that you would have had to pay a lot of money for. Very valuable level of animals. And this was an offering of the first order. That's why it's classified as the first order. There are orders below the first order where less and less expensive animals were offered in some cases where people simply didn't have the money to offer the kind of animal that was appropriate for their particular sin. And this includes the most expensive animals, of course, in all five types of offerings. If you remember on atonement, the high priest first went into the Holy of Holies with the blood of a bull, or bullock as it's called, in the King James, I think, but it's basically a bull. And today we simply call them bulls, the most expensive of the animals sacrificed at this particular time. All that was kept of the bull was the blood. And it was offered for the priest himself. But it was for his acceptance, not for his sin. Sometimes we miss that. We think, well, the bull had to be sacrificed so that the priest was made pure so that he could come before God. No, it's for acceptance to come before God in the first place that the bull was offered. In Leviticus chapter 1 and verse 4, Numbers 29 verses 7 and 8, there are a number of places that demonstrate that. Before God, He could not offer other offerings in blood for sin, so it was very similar to this concept of the burnt offering. He had to offer something in order to be accepted himself so that he could then offer other sacrifices as well. The animal in this case, of course, was fully burned. Later in Leviticus 16, a ram was used, or a male sheep, was offered on atonement for this purpose. It was also a first-class offering, or first-order offering, if you want to put it that way. Male sheep or rams were almost as valuable as the bull. Four things are probably what we want to notice about the burnt offering. There's four important things about it. Number one, it was a sweet savor offering. We already mentioned that. It is not for sin. No sin involved. Number two, it was offered for acceptance from God. We begin to get that concept of acceptance here. Number three, it was an offering of one's life, our life, in service or in sacrifice to God, which we cannot possibly fulfill. That's why we can't be accepted. You want to be accepted by God the way Christ was accepted by God, then your entire life, every moment that you exist, you are paying homage to your Father in heaven. You are sacrificing your life to God in everything you do, think, and act. Can you do that? None of us can. That's why Jesus Christ had to die as the burnt offering. Because none of us could make ourselves that acceptable to God. And Paul talks about it. Let's go there for a minute. He refers to it in Romans chapter 12. Very famous verse, but this verse now makes sense to me. Before, I wasn't quite sure why Paul was doing all that he's saying here. Romans 12, verse 1, it says, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable, your necessary service. Can you do that? Your entire life dedicated to God? In everything, every thought, every action, everything that you do. I wish I could. I can't say that. And none of us can. That's why Christ died this particular death, or this portion of the death represented by the burnt offering. Because we can't do it. He was accepted. Now, did I get to the fourth point here? I guess it was a whole burnt offering. Or holy burnt, as we say. W-H-O-L-L-Y. Holy, or entirely burnt, I guess is the word I want to use in terms of the sacrifice. So it was symbolic of one's offering one's entire life given in service to God. What did Jesus Christ do when he came to this earth as a human being? What did he say about himself? I'm here to do my Father's will. And he sought to do his Father's will in everything he did and said throughout his entire life. We would have to live that kind of life entirely without sin before we could be accepted by God. So with or without sin, I don't think any of us could lead that life to begin with. A male sheep or a ram was a very valuable animal, and it was one of the things that was offered in this particular case. Again, we can't hope to achieve living that kind of life before God. And that's why Christ died in our place as the burnt offering. The Israelite who offered a burnt offering was seen as a righteous man for seeking to approach God and to gain his acceptance. And that's why an Israelite could bring a burnt offering sacrifice to God. David talks about, I'll offer burnt offerings to you and all the things that he does in the Psalms to be accepted by God. We often think about, David brought all of those things for his sin. It wasn't for his sin. It was to be accepted by God. And that's what he was striving to achieve. It was very similar, if we want to look at this burnt offering, to our approach to God in prayer. We want God to hear our prayers, don't we? We seek for him to listen. We seek for him to be listening and to be involved with us and to communicate with us or to hear our prayer and our request from him. In all three major categories of sweet savor offerings, burnt, meal, and peace, the offerer comes to God seeking acceptance as the worshiper. Seeking acceptance. We all seek the acceptance of God. And in a New Testament sense, we have access to God already by the burnt offering and the meal offering already offered by Jesus Christ. But we're only allowed that access to God because of the sin offering that Jesus Christ also sacrificed because of our sins. If you notice Leviticus chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, I wish I had time to read through all of Leviticus. A lot of things would begin to jump to life as we go through it, but I don't have time to do that. Leviticus chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, it says, Speak unto the children of Israel and say unto them, If any man of you bring an offering unto the Lord, you shall bring your offering of the cattle, even of the herd, and of the flock. If his offering be a burnt sacrifice of the herd, let him offer a male without blemish. He shall offer it of his own voluntary will at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation before the Lord. The sacrifice in this case was to be voluntary. It was to be a male of the herd without blemish. And Christ was a perfect male without blemish. He was perfect and he was without sin. Then the male of the herd was killed, and the blood sprinkled about the altar. In the New Testament, the stake or the cross upon which Jesus Christ was crucified is symbolic of the altar, the brazen altar in particular, place of death of the animal, where the blood was drained out, where the animal died and was burned. It's symbolic of where Christ died as well. He was speared in the side, the blood ran down the stake to the ground, or the bottom of the altar, we might say. And we'll talk about the two altars that there are in the tabernacle and the temple a little bit later. There's the bronze altar or the brazen altar, and there's also the golden altar. And we'll talk about the significance of the two a little bit later, but we need to understand a little bit more before we get there. The burnt offering was to be totally burned on the brazen altar, except for the hide, in the case of the animal, or the crop of feathers, in the case of a bird. The hide was burned outside of the camp, on the ground. In the case of the burnt offering, or in the case of some other offerings, it was given to the priest. So the animal had to be flayed, in other words, the skin had to be taken off, before it was burned, because the skin really stinks when you burn it. Now remember, this is a sweet savor offering, so why would you make it such that it stank? I mean, obviously you don't. So God said, take the skin off, and or the feathers off the bird, and those also stink when you burn them. Take them outside of the camp and burn them on the ground. So that's what the priest did. The hide was burned outside on the ground, and so were the feathers. And the priests cured, in the occasion of some of the other sacrifices where they're allowed to keep a portion of the animal, they sometimes kept the skin and cured it. I don't know whether they made rugs out of them or bath towels or what they did with them. Who knows what the purpose was, but sometimes the priest would have kept the skin. But not in the burnt offering, because the burnt offering was considered entirely God's and dedicated to God. Burning either the hide or the crop stunk, so it would no longer be a sweet savor offering. Now, in verse 4, it says, "And he shall put his hand upon the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him." Now, we think immediately when we hear the word atonement, it's for sin. No. Atonement can be made for other reasons. It doesn't have to be sin that's involved. And atonement is not always for sin. And in this case, it was an appeal to God for acceptance. Because the entire animal was burned to a crisp, it often sent a very dark cloud into the heavens all night until the morning, especially when you had something the size of a bowl that was being burned on the altar all night long. And in this way, it was a visual appeal to God as well for acceptance. Verse 6, he says, "And you shall flay the burnt offering and cut it into its pieces," flaying it, taking the skin off. Obviously, they had to do that so that they could burn the skin without the camp. But also, it had to be cut up in pieces. So in many ways, the animal, we might say, was butchered before it was burned on the altar itself. And then they would lay the pieces on the altar in the order or arranged as though the whole animal was laying there on the altar. What are we seeing? Well, we're seeing Jesus Christ beaten and flayed alive by the lictor, the Roman lictor, who welded the Roman cat of nine tails with the ragged metal pieces in the ends of it, which shredded and ripped the skin off. So you see, the sacrifices are typical of what Jesus Christ would later do. Roman justice, as it was called. Christ was mocked and abused all night, too, just as the burnt offering, the smoke of it went up into the heavens all night. A terribly gruesome process invented by man, of course, to cause humans to suffer terribly. That's what the Romans were good at. In verse 9, we find the priests were to wash the inwards and the legs. Let's read that. But his inwards and his legs shall be, you shall wash in water, and the priest shall burn all on the altar to be a burnt sacrifice, an offering made by fire of a sweet savor unto the Lord. When you slaughter an animal, there's a lot of blood, a lot of mess. Why would you wash the innards and the legs before you put them back on the altar only to be burned? What's seems like a waste, doesn't it? But God has purpose in everything that he does, doesn't he? What do the legs of the animal represent? Its walk in life. Jesus Christ's walk in life was perfect. It was clean. What about the inwards or the innards of the animal? Back then, people believed that all of your emotions and your, your heart, your feelings, all of the things that are going on inside you, people believed those took place in the inner parts of the chest or the intestinal area. That's where they believed those emotions came from. Why would you wash the innards? Because Jesus Christ's emotions, his heart, his feelings, his thoughts were pure. So again, the symbolism here in the sacrifice, in what Christ did. His life was perfect and clean in every way, even to be sacrificed. All this, and according to verse 9, it would provide a sweet savor to the Lord that we just read. Notice, too, that neither the priests nor the offerer were to have any portion of this sacrifice. They were not to have any portion of this sacrifice, other than perhaps what we might cause to be, anyway, they weren't supposed to have any of it. God alone received it, basically, is what we're talking about. Excuse me. But sin is not the issue here, because no part of Christ's sacrifice here to date and what we've discussed here has to do with sin. He was not required to do what he did. His offering was a free will offering. Therefore, it was a sweet savor to God. God considers you as a Christian as a sweet savor to him when you offer up your life in dedication and service to him voluntarily. And that's what each of us did at baptism. We offered up our life to God. And we and our lives become a sweet savor offering, a whole burnt offering, if you want to put it that way, to God. Incidentally, fire. What's fire symbolic of? Anybody know? Similar to purification, but it's actually God's holiness. The altar purifies all. God's holiness burns up everything, including us if we happen to be in his presence without, without the proper authorization, without the proper purification, without the proper sacrifice and atonement made for us. That's why the high priest would have been cooked alive had he walked in on the Day of Atonement into the Holy of Holies without the appropriate sacrifices. Shot through, burned to a crisp. By the holiness of God. I'm not so sure that it would even require God's action for it to happen. We just simply can't enter his presence without what Christ did. Fire is the emblem of God's holiness. And so the burnt offering was made holy by fire. Burned up entirely, consumed in God's holiness. Our righteousness, rather than Christ's righteousness in us, is consumed wholly. Our lives, whether we live them as righteously as we can or not, is not sufficient to be a burnt sacrifice. That's why Christ's burnt sacrifice is offered in our place, and why it has to be. We see Christ in the burnt offering as A, the offering himself, him offering his body entirely, B, as the priest who offered it, and here he's the high priest in heaven offering sacrifices before God, and C, he is the offerer. He offered himself. He brought himself to the altar, so to speak, because we cannot offer ourselves completely to God as he did in service. We as Christians have already disqualified ourselves as a burnt offering to God and taking our portion of our lives for ourselves. What did you do before your calling? You lived the way you wanted to. You did what you wanted to do. You lived life the way you wanted to. Whether you sinned or not, you stole back what was rightfully God's in the way you lived and the way I lived. We as Christians have already disqualified ourselves as the burnt offering to God by taking any portion of our lives back for ourselves. We are owned entirely by God. We are bought with a very high price. We're owned entirely by God. Romans 12, verses 1 through 12, we read already. We are required to give ourselves as a living sacrifice to God. But being unable to do that, Christ had to do it in our place. Giving our entire lives to God, even the time before our calling, that's only our reasonable service to do those things. We're bought with a terrible price, and therefore we have nothing of our own to offer for ourselves. Our lives cannot be a whole burnt offering to God. We don't qualify. So Christ must stand in our stead as the whole burnt offering. What is it that God is most pleased with? What does he most desire from us in our lives? Our offering of ourselves to him completely in worship and service to him. That's what he desires. Can we do that? No. We can only do our best to do that. Our offering of ourselves to him completely in worship and service, that's what he wants. And that is the essence of the burnt offering. In many ways, the burnt offering is the fulfillment of what? It's the fulfillment of the first and great commandment, isn't it? Putting God first in everything. Isn't that what the first commandment's all about? That's what the burnt offering's all about, too. Putting God first in everything in our lives. That's what Jesus Christ did. We also find symbolism in the animals offered, too. The bullock was very strong, or the bull was strong in service. A very valuable animal, not just in terms of breeding, but also in terms of the work it performed. Oxes could, plow your fields. They could do all kinds of interesting things. It didn't have to necessarily be a male, but in that case, it's a very strong service-oriented animal. So it was chief among the sacrifices in that regard. The lamb represented passive submission without a murmur. Are we passively submissive to God without murmur, without grumbling? Boy, I wish we could be. The turtle dove symbolized an attitude of mourning innocence, sometimes called mourning doves. We could ask ourselves, is our service to God with those same attributes? Is there innocence in our worship of God? Just as there are four gospel records of Jesus Christ's life, in order to show him more completely, there are multiple sacrifices showing aspects of his offering to the Father for us to apprehend and to understand more fully about him and what he has done and what he is doing. Okay, we talked about the burnt offering. Let me talk about the meal offering. Now, that's another major issue. That's number 5 on your list. I'm going to skip down to it because we're going to come back to the other three. They have certain similarities later. I want to drop down to the meal offering because this is another aspect, and I guess maybe if you want to classify it, what's the second great commandment? Love for your neighbor, right? That's what the meal offering essence is. The burnt offering is our sacrifice to God, putting Him first. The meal offering is our sacrifice to our fellow man. In conjunction with the burnt offering, as we just talked about, I have to mention the meal offering because it's one of the five types, but it's also frequently offered with the burnt offering as well, and the peace offering. And Christ's sacrifice reflects them both. It was, first of all, a sweet savor, meaning it had nothing whatsoever to do with sin. The meal offering has nothing to do with sin. It represents man being offered to God in perfect obedience to God, yielding one's life to God, with the exception that one is offering their entire life to the service of their fellow man. That's what the meal offering really is about. The second great commandment. When you look at the sacrifices, boy, there's all kinds of stuff in the New Testament that begins to become clear, and clear as a result of the sacrifices as well. God accepts it as a pleasing offering or sweet savor because it's really Jesus Christ being offered, not us again. Can we offer our entire lives to our fellow man perfectly? Every thought, every action? No. That's why Jesus Christ had to be offered for us as the meal offering to God, because we can't do that either. Secondly, we see it's distinguished by its composition. It's composed of flour, an oil, and frankincense. Flour, an oil, and frankincense. The fruit of the ground we find allotted to man in Genesis 1, verse 29. That's basically what we're talking about here. It begins in Leviticus chapter 2, if you're looking for the meal offering, or what the King James calls the meat offering. It begins in Leviticus chapter 2, verse 1. And when any will offer a meal offering unto the Lord, his offering shall be a fine flour, and he shall pour oil upon it and put frankincense therein. Simple instruction for the meal offering. In one verse in your King James Old English, it will say meal or meat rather than meal. I think we understand that. It's a matter of translating the way the translators at one time, meat was just whatever you ate. It didn't necessarily mean meat of an animal. But that's the old English. But it symbolizes, and if you read through it and you look through and understand a little bit about the meal offering, in reading through it, you will see that it symbolizes the beating that Jesus Christ took in conjunction with his burnt sacrifice or offering of his life and shed blood to God for acceptance. It is also seeking acceptance. The flour was to be ground fine, pressed or beaten fine, and worn down, as trials often do wear us down. Just as Christ was beaten fine, so to speak, in terms of his suffering and all that he was abused in. In fine flour, there is no unevenness. In all circumstances, Christ was even in treatment. Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. Evenness throughout. Evenness in his life, in his treatment of others, in his behavior, and in his thoughts. The distinguishing difference between the burnt offering and the meal offering is that in the first offering, a life was offered. In the second here, the fruits of one's life were being offered. A life of sacrifice to others. The fruit is symbolized by the grains rather than the blood. It's the fruit of your life. What do you do with your life? Is it in service to others? To explain it further, we see that the fruits of one's life are what we do in service to our fellow man, not so much in our service to God. God doesn't need our works, does he? He doesn't need our works at all. But our works are often fruit of our service to our fellow man. Jesus' life was given to God as a whole burnt offering, but the fruit of his life was dedicated to his fellow man. And we see him continuously involved with and in the serving of people symbolized by the meal offering throughout his life on this earth. And we see it stand out in his washing the disciples' feet in John 13 at the Passover. When we offer sacrifice and our love to our fellow man, we are offering the fruits of our life to our fellow man. And that service is an emblem of our fruit or of our life, just like the meal offering was an emblem of the same thing. Here's where Cain failed to distinguish the importance of offering life or blood sacrificed to God versus to our obligation to fulfill. In other words, he was missing the obligation to fulfill his service to God. He was willing to sacrifice vegetables and the fruit of the ground and seed, but he was not offering a blood sacrifice. So, he didn't recognize his need to please God first. He didn't have his priorities right. God needed to be served first, not second. But Cain didn't realize that. And I feel God probably made the concept of that known to Adam, and probably Adam passed it on to his kids, but apparently Cain just didn't care to follow through with it, at least, because God was not first in his life. In verse 3 of chapter 2 here, I find it interesting that man nor priest could take part of Christ's perfect sacrifice, but the priests were eligible to take part of the meal offering. Why? Why were they able to take part? Well, the offerer was not. In other words, the offerer wasn't, but the priests were allowed to take a portion. Why? Well, because the priests also suffered in their physical lives oftentimes. The priests were able to take part in some of the suffering of the service that Christ did as well during the course of their lifetime. And you see that in the Old Testament. Frequently, priests were killed, murdered, whatever, during the course of the Old Testament. The priests were killed for some of the things they did. Notice, too, the flour was to be anointed with oil. And so we also see that the fruits of the whole life of the priests was a sweet savor to God. It was anointed with oil. And theirs was a life of service, just as Jesus Christ's life of service and fruit was pleasing to God, just as Christ means the anointed one. In Greek, that word is means anointed one. Same thing, Messiah in the Hebrew also means the anointed one. All of the meal offerings were to be anointed with oil, just as the Holy Spirit descended visibly upon Jesus Christ at his baptism. Came down as a dove, remember? In many ways, the meal offering is the fulfillment, of course, of the second great commandment. Again, something we as humans cannot fully accomplish. Therefore, Christ had to offer himself in order to accomplish it before God. Obviously, I've only been able to cover two of the sacrifices today. However, I will get to all three of the other five the next time we discuss them, but I also had to give you a lot of introduction here today as well to some of the concepts involved. So we may still get to finish it in two sermons, I hope, the next time I'm able to speak. I apologize, I don't have time to go into all the many lessons presented in the sacrifices for Christians, but when you understand as much as you will after the sermon, you can kind of look through the sacrifices yourself and begin to see a lot of things jump out at you that you may not have seen before. I'll mention some along the way, but it's impossible really to discuss every lesson contained in the sacrifices. But I hope that when we're done, you'll be able to do some of that looking yourself and begin to see some things you never saw in terms of the sacrifices and the lessons involved and all that they imply in it for the Christian.